Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwain aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 139.
PL Timestamp, Day 2420, Morning Lecture.
Eventually, Keltham does succeed in deriving, this time using dubious infinitary arguments, instead of clear and simple combinatorics, that indeed, if you start out thinking any fraction of left and right between 0 and 1 is equally plausible on priors, and you see experimental results going left on n occasions and going right on m occasions, the prediction for the next round is n plus 1, n plus m plus 2 for left, and m plus 1, n plus m plus 2 for right. Worth pointing out explicitly. You could see this whole fragment of mathematics, of law, as something that learns. If you show it 100 examples of balls with 70 going left and 30 going right, it'll start to predict future probabilities of left and right around 70% and 30%. It only learns a very restricted class of things compared to entire people. It can never learn if you show it the sequence left, left, right, left, left, right, repeated 20 times, that it should predict left with very high probability on the next two rounds, followed by right with very high probability. It'll just predict left with probability approaching 2/3 and right with probability approaching 1/3. This, of course, is because people contain much more complicated and powerful fragments of law within them, enabling people to learn much more complicated and powerful fragments of reality. Even Doth Ilan doesn't know that much law. It's the knowledge a god would need to build a mortal from scratch.
Certain parts of civilization do in fact secretly know that much law. It's unfortunately only one piece of a much larger, insanely lethal challenge.
Well, now she wants to know whether the gods know how to build mortals from scratch. Not the point, probably.
Keltham is having similar thoughts. He'll wonder out loud about whether Galarian's gods know enough law to do any significant editing. If the newcomers haven't read the transcripts for this part yet, or it was less clear from the transcript than in person, Galarian humans were obviously copied off some ancestors or cousins of Doth Ilan, visible from Galarian's multiverse, the same way Keltham himself was able to appear here. Keltham can eat Galarian food, and that doesn't happen unless the proteins inside are the same, and that requires common ancestry. Similarly, the humans here birth half women and half men, so nobody tampered with that part. If anything, Keltham's sort of surprised that people here aren't more edited. He wishes he knew what the gods' original edits to mortals were, whose reversion or failure was described as mortals gaining free will. That would provide a lot of hint about what level of innate law editing the gods were capable of deploying. He's guessing it was relatively shallow, though, not really anywhere near the level of make a mortal from scratch. Humans here wouldn't have shared ancestry with Doth Ilan if gods here could just make mortals from scratch. The fact that the gods' edits eventually failed, and that people basically turned back into humans afterwards, says that it was probably much more like imposing extra structure on top, maybe magical structure, not really remaking and rebuilding things like a programmer could do inside a computer, probably not even compiling new genes. Well, that seems to square with the rest of reality as Keltham observes it. None of the gods here seem powerful enough to be freely wielding law on that level.
Korva is pretty sure that the gods did create mortals from scratch at some point, even with the claims about heredity in some of the past transcripts which she has read. She's still extremely dubious about the idea that no higher power has ever shaped a lower one from nothingness or near nothingness, but it does seem possible that no mortal has ever developed the power. And if it can be done with math at all, then it makes sense that it's the sort of thing a mortal could do. If Keltham does know some sort of building block towards mortals, shaping mortals from scratch, that's the sort of thing that would go some way in explaining why the gods are so obsessed with him. It's terribly inconvenient that this would actually be an important thing to study, given that Korva hasn't been following along for the past several minutes, and is once again despairing of her future. Although if even Doth Ilan hasn't figured it out, then it seems pretty improbable that the collection of people here will. Maybe she can at least study the history of beings whose creation might have been directly observed or heard of secondhand. and whatever is known of the changes that occur to humans after death. There, not useless.
That's going to have people quiet, nervous of heresy. There are other races that are different from humans but similarly patterned. So, on your theory, I imagine the gods copied the shared ancestry that also produced Dathi Lan, and then made changes to produce, say, elves or halflings. And probably don't list the very large number of other species that are people, lest that get Keltham thinking about fire elementals.
It's said that the first world is what the first attempt at creation was like. So you might study the Fae if you were trying to understand how the gods shaped humans, Maritzel says. Aside from the thing where you definitely should not study the Fae.
You know, actually, also, who's to say that Daethalani weren't copied off of Galarion humans and then sequestered in some place as some random guy's experiment? Like, okay, yes, she's thinking about Hermia. Given that Galarion obviously has more planar and possibly even more interstellar reach, and there are various people who would absolutely do this, and that's why Dathi Lani apparently don't know anything about their history. Egotistical much?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of things in Galarion I'd run off and go look at, if it was safe for me to leave my fortress, and I didn't have more critical pathy things to do with my time. He does grok the concept of a critical path, though, that is also common wisdom out of civilization for people building startups. At some point, he may start to develop cabin fever, but day 20 is not that point.
Your regular reminder that I will do anything to go along with you at that time.
Yes, thank you, I'm aware. But as with sexual attraction of you towards me, my own desire to have you follow me around forever, telling me not to do things, may also take some time for me to develop.
Okay, just saying. You will die in 10 minutes if I'm not there, and you will somehow manage to get your soul stuck in the process.
Ione, I'm not saying no. I'm saying our Moira allegiance has not yet progressed to that point. Anyways, asterisk, not the literal baseline term. By way of finishing up the morning's lecture, Keltham will also explicitly spell out the point that, outside of particular meta-hypotheses you're deliberately reasoning inside, it's generally considered a bad idea to assign probability absolutely zero to anything, like the way that the rule of succession meta-hypothesis implicitly assigns probability zero, that the ball just always goes left, or always goes right, because then you can never ever learn that thing, no matter how much evidence is presented you. The rule of succession never figures that out for real, no matter how many cases of left it sees. If you assign probability zero that, good examples of somebody might think they were probability. Zero statements are harder for an outsider to come up with when they're relatively new to Galarion. If you assign probability one that grass is green, and then you go outside and suddenly all the grass looks blue to you, well, obviously you just conclude that your eyes are deceiving you. Sure, you're vastly more likely to see the grass looking blue, if in fact the grass looks blue. Maybe it's a million times more likely. But it's not infinity times more likely. If you say there's probability one that grass is green, you're saying that's infinity times more likely than any hypothesis where it's not green. And the evidence of your senses is always finite. They could always be mistaken. So if you have an infinite prior, that's like being something that can't notice the truth, ever, no matter how hard and how many times you're hit over the head with it. Thankfully, human beings are just more complicated things than the sorts of hypotheses that assign probability zero to the ball always going left. Even if your conscious deliberation somehow gets wedged into weird states where you claim to be infinitely sure of things, which, like, Keltham finds it hard to visualize anybody thinking that could possibly be a reasonable thing to do in the first place. Like, how would you ever be able to lawfully justify a claim to be able to guess something strongly enough that you could make guesses like that? Infinity times and be wrong zero times. But they did teach Keltham not to do that. So it's probably a sort of thing that people ever do, especially when they're kids. Even then, a human being is a more complicated thing, and there'll be meta-hypotheses inside you that some part of you is still processing, still able to learn the thing that you claim to assign probability zero. If you say to yourself that you believe absolutely that the ball can only ever have some propensity to go left or right, independently on each round, and any fraction between 0 and 1 is equally probable, and then reality shows you left, right, left, right, repeating forever. There will still be some part of you that notices, because you're not actually a kind of thing that can really assign probability 0 or probability 1 to anything in all of your parts just by saying that's what you're doing. There'll still always be some part of you that can learn from sufficiently blatant evidence that you're hit on the head with sufficiently repeatedly. If it's a sort of thing that humans assign probability greater than 0, equivalently, if it's a sort of thing that humans can learn, in the parts of you that your conscious decisions can't cripple enough. This was also told to Keltham when he was a child, and emphasized to him. He's not quite sure why it's important. No sane person would assign probability 0 to any interesting proposition in the first place, but it sounded like a warning, so he's repeating it.
That feels disquieting, somehow. She's not sure it is something to be thankful for, and she's not at all sure it'd be true of devils.
1 + 1 = 3?
Drugs, talk control, hidden super beings who created you from scratch to be mistaken about that. In Galarion, suggestions and more classified forms of mind control magic, gods directly messing with you, hidden super beings who could mess with gods. If one day you started adding 1 and 1 and getting 3 every time, including for things like physically adding an apple to an apple in a basket and getting 3 apples, you would eventually decide your old memories had been mistaken. It's a kind of pattern you would be able to notice if it were true. So the probability that all of yourself assigns to it isn't 0.
You know, some of these warnings do actually make more sense as things to specifically emphasize to people if Dathalani education actually was created by some process that was specifically reacting to things that had been seen on Galarion. Just saying. Well, thinking.
Some of these emphases would make more sense if the Dathalani keepers were specifically trying to counter Asmodeanism, as taught in Galarion. Maybe. Faith in gods in general? Pilar is less sure about that part.
And on that note of irreducible epistemological existential terror, let's break for lunch.
Well, that was one of the most unnerving mathematical experiences of Asmodia's life to date.
O'Tolman's was also unnerved by some of that so-called math. The fact that it worked is even worse. Mortals using invalid reasoning to arrive at correct answers may be all too close to using valid reasoning to produce wrong answers.
Well, timestamp. Day 24, 20, afternoon.
When it became obvious that Keltham would benefit from an alchemist, Chelyak started reviewing candidates. Alchemists, of course, don't tend to advertise all their breakthroughs. That's a great way to inspire people to send spies and steal all your hard work and secret recipes. If you drop by every alchemist's workshop and ask them how much they have independently cataloged properties of gases and metals, the floor will fold under you and drop you into a pit of acid. If you have been urgently dispatched for this task by the Crown, you presumably have a fly spell active, and you can remain in place and present your credentials and ask again, less politely. By the day after Keltham asks for an alchemist, they've screened some and picked one, and packed him off to Ostenso with a bag of holding stuffed with several thousand of his acid-damaged notebooks. He is carefully not looking at anything in particular about this place, in the hope that this will make it less necessary to kill him afterwards, so...
This is Keltham. He seems like an obvious mad experimenter alchemist apprentice, though slightly off in several ways. He comes from a world that has 0 knowledge of magic, and far vaster knowledge than Galarion of everything that isn't magic. And he's going to use that knowledge to cheaply produce vast quantities of distilled oil, of vitriol and drop spell, silver refining costs by a factor of 10. They're rapidly advancing in applying his otherworldly knowledge to Galarion. Today's frontier of research. Recreating an otherworldly instrument that will burn materials in flame and send the resulting light through a crystal to show the exact colors of light inside, to determine what fundamental constituents are within non-magical matter. Is that a sort of thing that'd be useful to alchemists in general, by the way? Elapse time until he acquired knowledge that Chelyax would kill him over 47 seconds.
Well, that's not great, but he'll just have to be very useful to this project, so he's kept around for it. That is indeed the kind of thing that'd be useful to alchemists in general.
Keltham is continuing to talk rapidly, obviously excited about this meeting. He is pleased to be introduced to what is, by his standards, an otherworldly mad scientist much like himself. Has the alchemist done a lot of experimentation on human subjects, by the way? And if so, what kind?
Yes, mostly for potion making rather than metal refining or distilling. He can't actually think of a useful human experiment he'd run on refining or distilling, but for potion making, you need human subjects for testing dose, testing effect duration, testing toxicity, testing side effects, and so on. It doesn't extrapolate reliably from rabbits.
Interesting. What's the most toxic thing he's found so far that way?
He's not actually a poisons expert and doesn't work with anything as lethal as, say, bluering. His potions experiments have mostly been on concoction miscibility, the known problem where taking multiple alchemical concoctions simultaneously has hard-to-predict side effects, some of them deadly and some of them actively desirable, so if you could only figure out how to reliably get the desirable ones, you'd be very wealthy selling to adventurers. Unfortunately, minutia of dosing that very person-to-person and day-to-day seem relevant to concoction miscibility, and of course, test subjects tend to expire of mistakes, so it's a difficult area to make progress in, but worth it when you have the subjects on hand.
The government doesn't require him to buy resurrection insurance or anything on them, does it?
That is the most baffling question he has ever been asked, and he does not like this entire line of questioning in retrospect. Depends. Is that how it's done on your originating planet?
His home planet doesn't have resurrections. No magic, remember? They put people into very deep cold instead, and will do something with them later. You can get people who'll let you kill them in alchemy experiments, but they're very expensive, obviously. What does the need for resurrection insurance depend on?
Sometimes your experimental subjects are old or sick and gonna die anyway, and in that case, you don't need resurrection insurance.
Uh-huh. And how much do subjects like that cost?
50 gold.
That does sound cheaper than resurrection insurance. Much cheaper. Makes you wonder why he'd use any resurrection-insured subjects at all, really.
Well, it's much harder to get those subjects.
Uh-huh. So they're much cheaper than resurrection insurance, but much harder to get. And how much does resurrection insurance cost for him?
It depends a lot on what specific experiments you plan to run.
Whatever he was working on last week will be fine.
He wasn't working on this last week. He doesn't do that much with admixtures. He thinks a couple years ago, when he last had a theory worth testing, it was 1,000 GP.
Keltham must have really not liked that answer. His whole face starts to change.
You failed at the point where you told Keltham that buying killable test subjects is much cheaper than resurrection insurance on them, but also they're much harder to find. If that had been true, their price would have gone up until the supply increased and the demand went down. Asmodea has now read an Abadaran book. Now,
all right. In this game of yours, how expensive are test subjects, and do you have to pay to resurrect them?
The girl who looks like and dresses like a Second Circle Ostenso Wizard Academy student is speaking very levelly. This is not a fucking game, Alchemist. You just failed a live fire test, one you thought was real. The only reason you're not in a lot of pain right now is that we do not expect putting that much fear into you to help you keep your composure around Keltham. Project Lawful has higher priorities than the Asmodean condition of your soul. But if you'd actually fucked up, tipped Keltham off, if he'd ended up in Osirion constructing weapons for them to use against Cheliax, and that was your fault, you would have personally pissed off, among others, the Queen of Cheliax, a Count of Hell who bought my soul on the speculation that Keltham would make it more valuable, and, probably, Asmodeus himself. Keltham has not, so far, probed any of the outside experts brought in. He has asked questions like that of project employees, which is what we are to him. If you are sticking around, then he will probably ask questions like that of you at some point. You're either ready for it when it happens, or you are a liability who should never be introduced to Keltham in the first place. 50 gold pieces for a death volunteer didn't sound impossible to me, given that slaves with a lot of lifespan remaining cost 75 GP. But that slavery is mostly illegal in Alter Cheliax. But if that's true, then you only use dying subjects and never buy resurrection insurance on healthy subjects. Everything about Alter Cheliax must be consistent.
How about I just don't deal in human subjects at all?
Are there alchemists like that in Tal'Dor?
I would assume so, what with how human subjects are expensive and irrelevant for most of what we do.
Then we may be able to get away with telling Keltham that lie. Why don't you work with human subjects? You don't come across as particularly squeamish in conversation and attitude. I suppose I've never actually met somebody who is, but Keltham will have.
Because it's a dead end? People have been trying to crack potion miscibility for as long as there's been alchemy. The first person to get it will be richer than the gods. But if you buy 100 fucking slaves and feed them all your perfectly optimized concoction, adjusted for their body weight and sex and astrological sign and hair texture, and whatever else you thought of, you'll get 100 different results and 5 of them will drop dead. And if you try repeatedly, then everyone will be dead by the end of the month. It's worth a try whenever you think you've thought of something new that it's possible no one else has found, but it's a stupid waste of time and money to try to build a career off. The interesting progress in alchemy is all in ores and oils, and rabbits are cheaper than slaves for practically all testing.
Is that what a Tal'Dorian alchemist who doesn't work with human subjects says? Because that sounded at least a little chelish to me, especially the part about slaves.
If you pay 100 elderly volunteers, they'll all be dead by the end of the month. If you want an alchemist from Tal'Dor, why didn't you hire one of those? I've never been to Tal'Dor.
It seems like they'd make that difficult for us. Try it again with an Eagle's Splendor. See if that helps your bluff any.
I think we also bring in the fake paladin. I have a sense that some of this would have twigged Keltham's sense for real evil, not what we've told him is evil. And that's something nobody else here knows how to fake caring about.
Carissa gestures at security to do what Asmodia said. How do people become an alchemist? How did you become one?
I was apprenticed to one, and I was the least incompetent of his apprentices. Do they have apprenticeships in Tal'Dor?
Yes.
Asmodia has a nervous feeling, as expressed within her state of continuous low-grade panic, that at some point Project Lawful is going to fuck up on account of nobody on staff being really actually good, knowing what that's like inside instead of outside. Not something that could be fixed easily, or at all, in any obvious way. But just because you can't fix something doesn't make it be not a problem. Why is her brain suggesting that they ask Pilar? Pilar's curse isn't that frequently helpful and couldn't be trusted anyways.
PL timestamp, day 24, 20, mid-afternoon.
Keltham returns from having taken a couple of hours break for wizard practice, scroll practice, and walking around outside, but still within the forbiddance. On his return, he finds... they've got an alchemist for him already. Apparently somebody saw this one coming and started the security screening process earlier. Good for them. Well, time to introduce himself and his work then. This is Keltham. He seems like a pretty extreme mad experimenter alchemist apprentice, the sort who's obviously going to end up dead within weeks, if not days. He's not just slightly off. Everything about him is way off in more directions than you can easily count. Today's frontier of research is a spectroscope, which burns matter and uses a prism to refract the light into component colors, or shines light through the burning material in order to check for absorption lines within the colors. Why is that important? Well, light is made of particles called photons. The color corresponds to the energy of the photons, and the emission absorption lines correspond to increases or decreases in energy of the electrons that are constituents of the atoms that are the almost perfectly stable constituents of matter. The electron orbitals are a huge determinant of how matter behaves chemically, how it gets transformed by acid or what other atoms it combines with into semi-stable molecules. Part of their major project here is to see whether informed use of prestidigitation can greatly change the reach of what's possible in chemistry. Prestidigitation can change color, stickiness, taste. These are all things that plausibly depend on electron orbitals. They've already verified that prestidigitation can change the reaction rate between acidic vinegar and basic wood ash lye. Lady Avaricia was first other than Keltham to prestidigitate matter, such that it would then burn with a different color of flame. Corva Talandria managed to get matter to not only burn with the color of sulfur, but to smell something like sulfur and to produce coughing, like sulfur dioxide. Keltham is hoping that by using a spectroscope on prestidigitated matter, his researchers will be able to get direct feedback on how their prestidigitation is changing the behavior of electron orbitals. That seems like it could be one of the key steps in learning to make elements behave like other elements that Keltham doesn't have time to identify in known Galarian materials, or even behave like elements that can't exist as ordinary matter. It will enable them to regularize the transformations that prestidigitation applies to materials, even if two different researchers think copper tastes slightly different to them. Keltham is mentioning all this, of course, because he's sure that the alchemist is wondering why, if you can use prestidigitation to control chemistry that easily, nobody's ever done it before. They've had some indication that you may need to know something about electron orbitals, before people seem to be able to conceive in the right way about which transformation they want to apply, by controlling the taste of something that would also make it burn a different color. His researchers weren't able to do that right away. As of yesterday, some researchers still couldn't. But also, Keltham is guessing that it would be a great deal more difficult to map your way through prestidigitating chemistry. If you didn't understand the underlying atomic interactions, started out by trying to prestidigitate complicated tastes into other complicated molecules instead of atomic tastes into atoms, and couldn't use a spectroscope to see what your early attempts at prestidigitation chemistry were changing about the electron orbitals. Besides making distilled oil of vitriol and refining spellsilver, are there any other non-magical chemical transformations that would be hugely profitable to improve, or that would be vital to the economy of Cheliax or other countries? Elapsed time before he learned knowledge that any government in Galarian would kill and soul-trap him over 3.5 minutes.
Yes, there are some. For non-magical reagents, the ones used at large scales where it'd be important to invent a cheaper version are bleaching powder, used in cloth production, and soda ash, used for glass, textile, soap, and papermaking. There's a standing large prize for a process to produce alkali from sea salt. Likewise, there are efforts to make naphtha, pitch oil, and sal ammoniac.
Keltham doesn't have memorized that many processes for producing chemicals at scale, alas. He knows one bulk process for producing an alkaline substance, the same way he knows a process for bulk producing the most industrially important kind of acid. Lady Avaritzia is trying to identify Galarian materials in terms of the underlying constituents of matter that Keltham is familiar with. She'd be the one charged with figuring out what soda ash and bleaching powder might be in his terms. Oh, also, the alchemist shouldn't take it personally if Lady Avaritzia thinks he falls far below her standards or seems rude. Lady Avaritzia is one of those people who can't bear to conceal outward appearances and thinks that everyone and everything is terrible. It's nothing personal if she thinks it about him, and says so out loud. What sort of incredibly finicky processes are there for producing small amounts of very expensive things, such that substantially higher demand would exist if the cost decreased? Spell silver itself is one of those things from Keltham's viewpoint. It's being produced in very small quantities, via a finicky process that Keltham hopes prestidigitation can smoothen and regularize, and there'd be demand for much higher quantities of spell silver if those were available.
This is so much better than the conversations with fake Keltham. He can name some candidates.
If there's one of those that has relatively less expensive inputs and is just labor costly because it's hugely finicky, the project might want to practice on that. And if there's none of those with expensive outputs, they could try perfecting via prestidigitation, in some processes that sell for less, if his researchers maybe want to mess around with it whenever, rather than, you know, the boiling acid version that should only be done in groups and with resist energy cast. Keltham has given them some known chemical reactions to mess with to see if they can steer around reaction pathways, but those reactions are pretty elementary and not that finicky to start with. There'll be some different game for mastering the trickier processes. Their current problems along the way to completing a distilled oil of vitriol production step include figuring out if they need to purify oxygen for step one, where they burn sulfur to turn it into sulfur dioxide, or if regular air works. If regular air doesn't work, they'll need to liquefy air to distill it, or use a controlled lightning process on water to make combined element 1 and element 8 gas. Also, It would be helpful to know if any of the create a bubble of breathable air spells work in a way where they can extract pure, regular air from that, which will be useful in chemical reactions. Either figuring out some known Galarian metal is element 23, or getting something else to act as 23 for purposes of its oxide catalyzing SO2 and GT, SO3, or directly prestidigitating SO2 in a way that makes it easily combine with oxygen at high temperatures to form SO3. They also need to know if pure oxygen, or at least pure air, is required for this step. Keltham suspects you can't just use atmospheric air here, but he's not actually sure. Measuring temperatures for purposes of getting the SO2 and GT, SO3 furnace to above the melting point of water by 450% of the difference between the melting and boiling point of water. Mercury thermometers don't go that high, and are kind of dangerous anyways, unless they're very certain that healing or restoration works to solve a long-lasting poisoning problem with mercury.
Restoration should fix damage from mercury. He can't think why it wouldn't. He avoids suggesting a quick human subject test to be sure. He does happen to know that bubble of air spells make air rather than pure oxygen. Pure oxygen has been isolated, and he has a secret technique for doing so, as well as one for measuring temperature, which he'd be willing to share with this project for half its proceeds.
Half the proceeds from what exactly? Selling the purified oxygen if the project can figure out how to make his process scalable, and they can't find a better process that's more scalable and not derived from his?
Half of the proceeds from selling or selling the secrets to making the alchemical products and ores refined alchemically and oils produced alchemically this project is hoping to produce.
Doesn't particularly match up with Keltham's model of how hard it would be for him to produce oxygen or find another alchemist who knew how. There's a lot of stuff with oxygen in it. Water is 8-9 oxygen by weight, and Keltham knows how to split it. There's no way that saving a couple of weeks on hammering out the issues in a reconstructed method of Dath Elan would be worth half the proceeds of the project on all chemical sales forever. Oxygen simply isn't that important. An input. Keltham has in fact heard about Galarian's concept of bargaining, and could potentially try doing things that way by countering with a ludicrously unfair offer of his own. But first, Keltham wants to make sure that he's not missing some key facts that would make this a sincere and fair offer, one that Keltham shouldn't be trying to bargain down from. Keltham's got truth spells, and also a spell that causes people to only say prices that would be fair, given their knowledge. If the alchemist wants a quick way to prove that he's being honest about something, or just prove that the entire offer is one that's fair, relative to his own model of things.
The alchemist doesn't know what Keltham means by a sincere and fair offer. It's sincere in the sense that if Keltham takes the offer, he will share all his secret techniques. It's fair in the sense that it's 50-50, which is, in some sense, the fairest possible division of anything. Is that what good people think? He knows secret techniques for other chemicals and is willing to teach them too for half the proceeds. Notably, alchemists don't usually teach their techniques at all, certainly not to someone who wants to scale them. Why, then you'll never make money off it again. You sell the results and keep the process secret. He is only offering to sell the techniques at any price because this project does seem promising.
Keltham is not particularly expecting the alchemist's personally derived secret knowledge, relative to more public and commonly known alchemical knowledge, to contribute even 0.1% of what Keltham remembers from an entire alternate world, with a vastly more advanced comprehension of non-magical materials. Science. As produced by literally millions of alchemist equivalents with 20-plus intelligence, freely sharing results with each other, and paying patent gratuities on useful discoveries in proportion to how useful they were. If the patent gratuity methodology was applied to the project, they'd end up paying him for the 2 weeks of time that ended up being saved by their using his secret oxygen production technique, or more if it later turns out that it'd have taken longer than 2 weeks to get lightning-based water splitting going. The basis on which Keltham had been planning to do this was more pre-negotiated, though. If the guy proved as valuable as a regular project employee, Keltham was going to offer him the 0.1% share of the project that non-elite employees get. If as valuable as an elite project employee, the 0.2% that elites get. That'll be harder for him to sustain over time, as the younger project employees learn more new methods and math, but earlier contributions are also more valuable. Those shares of the project do need to last through all the employees that will prove worthy of them. Later employees will get offered more, like 0.01%. If the alchemist isn't happy with either of those, the project will pay his regular consult fees, not give him a share of the project, and use only what's public knowledge in Galarian. Keltham assumes the guy has already signed the standard non-disclosure agreement, saying that he cannot, without the project's permission, use or talk about stuff like prestidigitation chemistry. Also, can the guy use prestidigitation? Because if not, he may need to spend a week picking that up.
0.1%? A thousandth? For an alchemy project without an alchemist on staff?
Has somebody possibly not explained the scope of the project to him? The plan is to use the knowledge out of Keltham's world to revolutionize all non-magical farming, medicine, cloth making, mining, metallurgy, manufacture, road making, etc., all of which actually scale up much further than Galarian has taken them so far. Probably also use the methodologies out of Keltham's world to revolutionize a bunch of magical stuff, too. Roughly, the plan is to turn Galarian into its own version of his civilization, as the people of Galarian may want to become that, and the project is step one of it. If all dreams fail, and the project ends up being worthless, as does not particularly seem likely at this point to be the case, then the alchemist still gets to keep his usual and customary fees, and the people on the project can sign non-disclosure about whatever secrets of his he revealed to them along the way. Alternatively, if the project plays out to the extent of being able to capture one gold piece of value created for everyone in Galarian, it ends up worth something like 1 billion gold pieces on that theory, and 0.1% is worth 1 million gold pieces. This is what the God War a couple of weeks ago was about, FYI. It started with Zon Kuthon trying for a decapitation strike on the project, 2 days after Keltham arrived in Galarian.
Right, okay then. He does want the non-disclosure agreements in the case the project fails arranged first.
Naturally.
Also, he would absolutely leave if that was possible, but he's not going to say that.
Keltham will work up a non-disclosure agreement shortly. They can stick to public knowledge about alchemy until then. Most of them this afternoon are going to be working on completing the spectroscope as equipment. Can Keltham turn him over to Lady Avaricia, so Lady Avaricia can introduce to him the basic concepts out of civilization? And he can see if his public knowledge works for helping her to complete her project on relating Galarian concepts to Dathilani ones. Again, it'll seem like Lady Avaricia hates him, but it won't be anything personal, and he doesn't need to be guarded or tactful around her either.
Yes, he can do that. Is it her husband's title or her parents?
Parents, Keltham thinks. Something about a county she's heiress of.
Right. He appreciates the clarification, such as it is, and would be happy to work with the Lady Avaricia on the spectroscope if it pleases her.
Literally, nothing's going to please Lady Avaricia until the project scales to the point of distributing artifact headbands with +6 intelligence to people who were otherwise nearly the smartest innate prodigies in the world before then, whereupon they may begin to barely meet Lady Avaricia's standards.
Just get over here and assist me already. I don't prefer you standing around.
Great, he'll do that. He's so looking forward to being part of this fascinating project.
Message to Lady Avaricia. Guy seemed slightly weird. Please observe and report back if he seems even more horribly incompetent than you'd expect from the next best alchemist to pass their security screen.
But she's desperately curious what specifically about that Keltham thought was weird, but doesn't ask.
They'll almost get a spectroscope working before Keltham calls it a day.
Pill timestamp. Day 24-20. Evening.
Martial arts practice. It's getting a little psychologically easier each time, as his mind accepts that injuries to himself and others just are not permanent. He can't feel about pain what Carissa feels, he doesn't think. But there's a triumph in making it through, walking away healed and less afraid, step by step becoming somebody who's been in a fight. The thought of fighting Meritzel at all, let alone Meritzel transformed into Carissa, still seems flinchy. He might possibly need to equip Meritzel with a dagger, or something else that makes her look more dangerous, and be attacked by her first, before he'll feel okay about fighting back. It'll probably go away, that hesitation, after the first time. Things like that are usually like that, right? Using bull's strength and cat's grace to train martial arts is like soaring, Keltham would say, like flying, but eventually he'll be able to fly, or cast it from scroll, and probably that'll be a totally different sort of soaring experience. At fourth a circle, Keltham can't sustain those enhancements through a whole training session. Nor would he should also train fighting unenhanced, but Keltham begins and ends with them, each time. Because elementary hedonics. He'd thought to date Ione tonight, but ended up feeling not in shape for it, after martial arts practice. It's by far the most mentally strenuous thing he's done repeatedly since he came to Galarian. He summons Yaisa instead, tells her to be slow and gentle, to make him feel cared for, and lets her do all the work. He should probably talk to Maritzel soon, if she's amenable, fight her soon, and get that part over with.
PL timestamp. Day 25. 21. Morning lectures.
All right, Keltham knows this is probably going to be a bit stressful, but the new researchers are coming up on the end of their trial week tomorrow. Keltham, in retrospect, has not been stress-testing them to the same extent as he stress-tested the current researchers before they got hired. They've now been introduced to the simplest of inductive law fragments, the rule of succession. Armed with that, they should be able to figure out how you'd go about deciding whether two different sources of lefts and rights had the same frequency, or a different frequency, if the datasets weren't so different as to make it obvious at a glance. And say what it is that an experimentalist out of civilization would say, and not say, in their report summarizing their data. It's not going to be, I decided these two sources were the same, or I've started betting these two sources are different. And maybe talk about a certain general symptom of error that might appear, abstracted beyond just the rule of succession, if two different experimenters had ended up performing different experiments with different properties, without anyone realizing that earlier, when somebody went through the reports out of civilization side by side. If they can keep going, and find even more to say, they're welcome to do that. Split up and try it on your own. Everyone should have been told earlier this morning to prepare one fox's cunning and one owl's wisdom. You may use those at will. Researcher candidates will also get an additional fox's cunning supplied by staff. You've got until lunchtime. Note, this test does not completely determine your final relationship to Project Lawful. Keltham has been watching them this whole week, not just now. Keltham doubts his saying this will affect Lady Avaricia in any way, so he will mention, for example, that Lady Avaricia could completely blow this one, and still get in on the strength of her chemistry work. People can also end up rising or falling in tier over time if they're hired. So don't stress out too much over this one test, is what Keltham would like to say, but yeah, realistically, he knows they're going to stress out about it. He apologizes for that part. Last time the researchers ended up not knowing exactly what they were being tested on, and that was not really a better way of doing things, he doesn't think. There'll be a predictable 2-hour recovery period after lunch, before they start the afternoon's research. The whiteboard now reads, wielding the law of succession, that after N lefts and M rights, the odds of left versus right are N plus 1 to M plus 1. Figure out how you would analyze whether source 1 and source 2 of lefts and rights had the same propensity, P for left versus right, or different propensities, P1 and P2. Assume it's not obvious at a glance. Say what an experimentalist out of civilization would say or not say in their summary of their data. It won't be, I decided these two sources were the same, or I'm betting these two sources are different. Talk, if you have the time, about a general symptom that might appear, not just in analyses using the rule of succession. When two different experimenters end up performing an importantly different experiment. On reality, and end up with two datasets generated by importantly different sources, as might turn up when someone out of civilization was analyzing their datasets or experimental summaries side by side. You are welcome to say more, if you have more to say.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 7776059.